Castile. My guest today, Jason Harrington of Lullaby Sound Design, is also an incredibly talented singer, songwriter, musician, educator, all things of the written word, and with your hands. Whatever can be shaped and molded with your hands. Is that not true? Welcome, Jason.
Well, sometimes I try to. I try to.
Yeah, it's great to have you here today. Most people know you from the band The Specklers.
Right, right.
Which I have to say Dominic Cross wrote a wonderful article recently about how bands have to rotate through members and
right.
and the effect that that has on. But I want to step back a bit, Jason. For people who aren't familiar with you, there has been two arts, or maybe three arts, that I know of in your life, and it's music.
Correct.
And sculpture.
Correct.
But also looking at some other things now with amps, with wood and metal. But when you look at sculpture or visual art and music, what came first in your life?
It's always been music. As far back as I can remember, I've always kind of understood things through music.
That's a really interesting way to say that I understood things through music. What's that about? Why do you phrase it that way?
It's either been through the lyrical content, through the experiences that are presented, or just through the actual composition of the song, the way things work together, the way things change, the way parts have to contrast each other. To me, it really makes a lot of sense with other things that I do as well.
So you were about how old when music entered?
Oh, that's
young.
Early as I can remember.
Yeah. And what was the first instrument?
I sang.
Vocals.
I did. I sang from I used to ride in the middle of a pickup truck and sing into the shifter. It was one of those big 3 foot long ones. And I we had a John Anderson tape.
Oh, how wonderful.
I think it's still probably burned into my brain somewhere.
And the shift would become your mic.
It would.
Fabulous.
So later on, I went through the school band, and I did saxophone and drums and other woodwind instruments.
Oh, okay.
But it's really always kind of been more melodic instruments versus rhythm instruments.
Yeah. Well, so when did guitar come in?
Later in high school. Mm-hmm. Kind of, you know, for different reasons, got together with a few people and formed a band, and that just kind of became the instrument that I went to. I wasn't originally intending to sing in any of those situations, but that kind of just came about.
Yeah. And were you involved in, you know, choirs and things like that in high school or no?
I never did anything like that. I did for a little while. I guess once I was 20 or so, I tried to kind of go that route and do some formal type things, and it just never really felt I fit into it.
Yeah.
So I kind of just backed out of that and just keep doing things the way I do.
Yeah. So you get out of high school, and sculpture came into your life at a certain point.
It did. Later on, around 2004, I knew I wanted to go back to school for something, wasn't exactly sure what it was going to be.
Yeah.
Somehow wound up in a sculpture major. And it was one of the best decisions of my life. I never learned so much about music, in fact, as I did when I was learning sculpture.
Talk about that. How so?
Well, in fine arts education, there's a formal training that you can go through where you actually learn about the principles of fine art, the elements of fine art, and the way that you can make two different shapes interact by repetition of that shape, the way that you can do things with variety and unity and making these pieces come together.
Yeah.
And it really clicked as far as with composing songs. Going from one part to the other. How does one part interact with another? And it really allowed me to look at a song as a single piece.
So prior to getting involved with sculpture, you were already writing music?
I was.
So did it change the way you looked at it?
It certainly did.
Yeah.
And it was just I always kind of wrote in a linear fashion. I would start at the beginning, write to the end, and the end didn't always necessarily refer back to the beginning.
Yeah.
by doing it this way, thinking about it as a single thing, it allowed me to kind of take a step back and make sure that it worked as a cohesive whole.
Yeah.
And it gave me a whole new way of understanding things and also a whole new way of listening to music.
So with what kind of sculpture were you focusing on? All kinds?
I was mostly taking abstracted organic forms. I was really interested in how seeing a certain form or a certain shape could elicit a biological response in people. You know, certain things can make you feel certain ways. Certain things can be attractive, whereas certain things can be, repulsive.
That's right.
And I find it very interesting as to where those things might come from.
Yeah. Did you ever do a show with any of your work, your visual art?
I did. I did during college, I did a few installations. And since then, I've put up a few things and done work for friends' different music videos that have been filmed. I've made things for the guys with The Botanist to include in their works. They do some kind of strange things.
And so
I've still been working.
I'm curious, when you did some of those shows in college where you did the exhibits, did you notice people's reaction?
I did. It was very interesting to talk about these things because all the forms were abstract, but the ideas are abstract as well.
Yeah.
So whenever you start playing with metaphors and playing with references, you really kind of put yourself out because you don't always know what those references are associated with for individual people.
That's right.
So a certain reference or a certain metaphor can mean something to me, but it might come across in a very different way to someone else.
And to each of those people that views your work.
Correct, correct.
You know, I mean, that's the thing I've always been fascinated with that style of art is, you know, I'll have a really good friend who will all of a sudden start talking about what they saw, and it's like, where did that come from?
Right.
You know?
Correct.
But then it's interesting to hear them talk about where that came from.
Yeah. It can give you a whole new way of looking, a whole new perspective to see things.
Yeah. And so in talking about that then, did that then relate to your songwriting in terms of is there always like a clear message that you're getting out of your songs or is it left to the ears?
It depends.
Yeah.
Sometimes it goes either way, to be honest. I find that the more I try to restrict myself or the more I try to control what I do, the less I'm able to do anything at all. So sometimes I'll let, 10 or 15 different things come through knowing full well that 12 or 13 of them aren't going to make any sort of cut.
Yeah.
It's just to keep that channel flow and keep things coming through.
Hey, I'm curious, when you started writing, Jason, was it for music, for songs, or was there just doing poetry or a short story or something? Or
I did do some short story writing when I was younger.
Yeah.
That never really caught on with me so much or held my attention quite as long.
Yeah.
So most of the writing I've done has been songwriting, music writing. Plus, it's a medium where it's easy to interact with other people through it.
Yeah.
You know, so always having access to friends who played, always having access to a band to play with, it gave me a venue to write for.
Yeah. Do you have a structure in terms of what you hear first? Is it the melody or is it the lyrics?
It just depends.
It really can
come from different places.
And,
and it doesn't always happen the same way.
Yeah. When you first started writing and the style of music that you started out with, similar to what you're playing today?
Very different. I've gone through a few different phases, I guess I should say, are different stops. Kind of did a lot of kind of blues-based rock things. That's kind of where I learned. And that's just the music I was familiar with at the time. Since then, my songwriting has kind of tailored itself to the new way that I'm running the Specklers.
You talked about a bit of this in Dom's article.
Right, right.
Yeah.
And part of what that is that with the Specklers, on any given night, I may have two people on stage who have never played the songs, maybe never heard the songs.
Yeah.
And because of that, in order to make that work, in order to to be able to do that, I try to keep them in somewhat of a recognizable structure, at least as far as chord changes and things like that go.
Yeah.
So that a seasoned player can listen along and,
sure.
and play along
yeah,
and
yeah.
not hit them with too many curveballs.
Yeah, yeah. So the folks that come in I'm going to back up first, though.
Sure.
The Specklers, the name.
Yes.
What's the history of the name?
The Specklers are kind of just a name of the group that plays my songs at the time. So it's become an evolving band, a revolving door. And the word doesn't have any associations. I'm very, very,
Okay.
I'm very, very conscious and careful when I'm writing about word associations.
Yeah.
And I never forget when I learned that I think it's like 15 or 20 different languages. I don't even remember. But the word for mother and father all use the same syllables, which clued into me something that there's something biological about the sound of syllables.
Sure, yeah, yeah.
So it became, you know, something I became very careful of and cautious of. So
yeah.
when figuring out what we were going to call this thing, something about the sound, the feel of the Specklers in my mouth, and the fact that I couldn't really attach it to anything individually drew me to it.
Yeah. It's a good name, and it's a easy name to remember, but it's – I mean, it's catchy.
It's sharp.
It is. Speckler. I mean,
correct.
You know, when you say that's right. That's okay. That's an interesting point. I'm intrigued about, because you've said it a couple times in here, about that biological response, that whole.
Right.
You know, that came into your life through sculpture. That's how that concept first came in, or do you think you paid attention to that before sculpture?
I think I paid attention to it, but sculpture gave me a way to understand what I was thinking about.
Okay.
It gave me a kind of a lab to experiment in to learn about that idea.
Yeah.
I think about it like I have a dog, my dog Ike. The first day I brought Ike home, riding in the car, he vomited all over my lap.
Yeah, yeah.
Lovely.
Yeah, yeah.
Ever since that moment, Ike has a high anxiety whenever he gets into the car.
Sure.
Because it made him sick.
Sure.
So that kind of thing makes me question myself. Why do certain visions, certain shapes, certain sounds cause certain responses in myself?
Yeah.
Is it connected to something at some point, or is it, I don't know, it's just something I'm interested in?
Well, you know, so I'm curious. When you're up there performing on stage,
mm-hmm.
whether it's a band or, you know, two of you or one of you.
Right.
Do you pay attention to that in the audience? Are you able to, or is that a whole separate?
It depends. Sometimes, I try to watch people. I try to see, you know, what people are listening to. You can tell when something gets someone's attention.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, what's causing feet to move, what's causing hands to slap and fingers to snap.
Yeah.
So there's always that interaction, and it definitely is an interactive type of thing. I feel for the guys I play with sometimes, because I never stick to any kind of a set list or anything, because it's always developing. It's always the show itself kind of dictates that.
Yeah.
You know.
You know what's interesting? I was thinking about this as you were talking, that you on stage, and for people that haven't, you know, seen Jason on stage and with the Specklers, it's your physical being up there, your movement, you have a really, I'm not sure what the way that you move on stage is very, I'm losing track of what I want to say here.
I'm a little scared with where you're going.
Oh, no, not at all. No, it's very cool, but it's very, you have this great way of how you move to what you're playing, and there is some very almost kind of like determined movements in your head and how your shoulders and but it's interesting listening to you talk about how you pay attention to how those sounds affect, you know, people's responses. There is a response that I see from you when you're up there playing that is more pronounced than some other musicians that I've watched, if that makes sense.
I guess I could see that.
And I mean that as a compliment.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, it's a really interesting – because that's the one thing that first struck me about you before I really took in what you were playing is it was this very physical, very interesting physical being to watch up there.
Well, that's cool.
Yeah, because there's this whole you know, you have a look that you have when you're up there, but it's how your body moves and how your – yeah – there's a very pronounced movement.
I'm certainly going to be self-conscious about that.
Yeah, I don't mean to make – you know, but that clicked for me while you were talking about how certain sounds – and it's like, wow, do you respond to your – you know?
I may.
Yeah. I mean, that's the first thing I thought of. It's like, wow, he responds to that. You know, how he's perceiving that maybe other people would. I think he's responding to it. Yeah, it's that's interesting. So, yeah, not to make you self-conscious. Keep doing what you're doing because it's cool. You brought a guitar in today.
I did.
You have a harmonica.
I do.
What you going to play for us?
Let's see. Earlier in the year, I was involved in a stage play. I had the opportunity to play the role of one of my hometown heroes, Bobby Charles.
What was that in?
It was called In the Wake of Time. It was produced by the Alame Society in Vermain Parish.
Wow. Where did you guys perform that at?
It was performed in the Abbey Players Theater.
It was there.
It was.
I am sorry, I missed that. Wow, I don't remember hearing about that.
So it was a great experience for me. The focus of the play was on the community of Vermain Parish and how all the different elements involved.
Yeah.
And one of the lines in the play and kind of one of the motifs was to be where you're from, you know, to engage and embrace the community and the culture that created you. And that really kind of stuck me and kind of hit me, being from Abbeville as well and from Maine Parish and growing up in that place. Earlier we mentioned I'd done a installation,
yeah.
Sculptural installation. The title of that installation, oddly enough, was You Have Been Where You Are, What Are You Now? And what I was dealing with was the effects of socialization on individuals and creativity. And,
sure.
I used, I think it was 360 small figures arranged into a circular pattern to kind of try to communicate this idea that through socialization, I have trouble with that word, apparently.
Yeah.
Our rough edges, our you know, our quirks are kind of encouraged to be shaved off so we fit these molds.
Right? Yeah.
And a lot of those ideas came from growing up in that culture in South Louisiana, you know.
Yeah.
And when I heard this line, be where you're from, you know, it hit me in a different way than I could have heard possibly 10 years ago.
Yeah, yeah.
In that it encourages embracing and engaging your community,
yeah.
Not necessarily unquestionably accepting things, but just embracing it.
Sure.
So when I was writing this song, I decided to embrace and engage the Vermain Parish Solid Waste Facility, which is a
all right,
which is the local landfill.
Yeah.
Have you been there?
Not to that one.
No, I'd imagine
but
it's similar to other landfills. Anyway, one thing about this particular one that I know in general is there's a huge population of birds there.
Oh, yeah.
Mainly egrets, the large white cowbirds. And, I used to be a little more cynical than I am now, maybe.
Yeah.
Growing up, seeing these things, I would always think, you know, how sad it is. They all have to congregate here so they can scratch through and find food in our trash. And,
yeah, yeah.
You know, now I look at it a little more satirical kind of way, and
yeah.
I think, you know, it's not a bad gig for them, you know. Plenty of things to eat.
Yeah.
I don't think you can hunt in the Vermain Parish Solid Waste facility.
No, safe.
So maybe the joke's on us.
That's right.
That one, but anyway, this song is called Landfills.
All right.
It's written from the perspective of one of our feathered friends.
All right.
Have to make sure the harmonica's close. Sometimes I don't realize till halfway through a song that I have the wrong one on there, and that becomes a scramble. Slicing through the altitude, aiming for the sun. The blisters on my wrinkled feet will soon be all but gone. Flapping towards the trapdoor light, ever gazing down at tire tracks and electric lines that grid the patterned ground. When I was just a little bird in my mama's nest, never knew the world outside would offer such unrest. Now I see those crippled dreams are only dreams at best. When I heard the news, I learned the flu, and I quickly headed west. Settled high atop a pile of broken furniture. The liquid lines of veneered pine awoke memories from home. But the tractors came, and once again that old refrain was gone. So I circled till the twilight killed the last remaining hums. Man, I spotted spots across a space of littered, hallowed ground. A reservation now reclaimed by all who've circled round. A feathered flock of tattered stock, all samsara bound. I let the wind escape my wings and laid my body down. And I sang, thank God for this landfill. I've finally a place to land. And fill my beak and belly with plastic-colored sand. But I won't fall down on my knees, 'cause I know where I stand. I'm back, yes, I'm back. I'm back where I begin. I'd think that bitterness would fill my feathered heart, but truth be told, the streets are gold amid these littered parts. There's treasure in the trash that blooms beneath the glistening stars. And from sunset till dawn appears, this piece of land is ours. And we sing, thank God for this landfill. We finally a place to land. Fill my beak and belly with plastic-colored sand. But I won't fall down on my knees, 'cause I know where I stand. I'm back, yes, I'm back. I'm back where I begin. I'm back, yes, I'm back. I'm back where I began.
Very nice. If you're just joining us, this is The Exchange on KRVS 88.7 FM or on the web at krvs.org. Remember to like us on Facebook and also a secure, safe website. We are listener supported. Offer a lot of news throughout the site, too. If you're joining us, that was Jason Harrington, my guest today. Jason, that was lovely.
Well,
landfill.
Thank you.
You know, it's interesting, though, that is something where, you know, birds are very popular at landfills and where a lot of, you know, some landfills have combined a bird sanctuary with that actual landfill, you know. But that gives you a good way to look at it.
It does, another perspective.
So was that a song you sang in that show?
It was not.
It was not. Okay.
It was not.
But that was kind of the inspiration for you Thinking just, about Vermilion.
This kind of one.
Well, so performing in that production that you did in Abbeville, how did you get involved? I mean, had you done any acting before, been in a stage show like
not
that?
Not since I was, I think, in probably 6th or 7th grade.
Yeah.
And so, I don't know how much choice I had involved in that one.
Yeah,
but
yeah,
no,
that's right.
So no, I hadn't.
So
I
how
hadn't.
Did this come about?
Well, it was somewhat of an accident. I had I teach in Vermilion Parish.
Yeah.
And part of outreach into the community from the school, I was trying to get involved with some things, me and a few guys I work with. And I was going to do the music for the production.
Okay.
Which, from what I understood, just meant playing a few songs at the beginning, playing a few songs in the middle, something like that.
Yeah.
And then it turned out I found out on the first day of rehearsals, I guess they were, that I would highly, you know, or I was suggested to play Bobby Charles as a role in the play.
Yeah.
So it was... It was a great opportunity, and I certainly enjoyed it.
It's a lot of work to
be
in a state.
It is a lot of work.
I mean, a lot of people have no idea until
unbelievable.
They...
Unbelievable. Yeah. It was 3 weeks of my life that everything else went on hold.
That's right.
We put together a show with 69 cast members.
69?
69.
Holy
and
cow.
The vast majority, like me, had not done this.
Yeah.
And probably over half were children, and... In 3 weeks, the whole thing came together.
Who directed that?
It was directed by a group called Community Performance International. It was written by Jules Corey and directed by Richard Gere, not the pretty woman.
Yeah, yeah, another Richard Gere.
Another Richard
Gere.
Well,
was that an outside company that came in to produce
they
that?
They were contracted by Alame to write the stories. Basically, they collected stories from different groups in Vermilion Parish.
Yeah.
This company took all of those true stories and combined them into a cohesive storyline, and it became the play.
Yeah. That's a cool thing for that area.
It was excellent.
You
it
know?
Really, really was a nice thing for the community.
Wow. Yeah, another thing to chalk up in your experience.
Yeah.
You know, you talk about teaching in Abbeville, and so you teach language. Writing.
I do.
The students, they're 7th grade?
Correct.
Age?
Correct.
What are some of the important things that you want them to take out about writing? What do you want them to learn or to realize?
I think one of the most important lessons I've ever learned from a creative standpoint or from making anything, I learned from Steve Breaux.
Steve
Breaux's an artist
here
in town.
At the
university. Amazing guy, one of my favorite people on the planet. Basically, it's the idea that there's no such thing as a mistake. There's no such thing as doing something incorrectly.
Yeah.
You just have to be willing to not stop until it's right. Go back into it, learn from it, build from it, build on it, erase it.
Yeah.
Whatever the case, don't be afraid to throw things out there because it doesn't have to be the final end-all result.
And my guess is going back to that until it's right, until it feels right to you.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct. And so it's, you know, everything, I think everything is and should be in a constant state of revision.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Yeah, that's an important point, that it's not a mistake.
That's it. Just
it's
keep going.
It's part of that process.
It might not make its way into the final product.
Yeah.
Or into the, you know, but.
You know, I have asked a couple other guests on here this question one, because it was such a great question. I was doing a program where Daryl Bork was involved, a poet from the area and former poet laureate with the state. And one of the students, their high school age students, asked he and Patrice Melnick, another writer that was with him, how do you know when you're good? And, you know, that threw them both for a loop for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And so what if somebody was to ask you that? How do you know?
Well, I play an acoustic show around town. I've been doing so for 8 or 10 years.
Yeah.
And my set is comprised of probably 200 songs. But it's all songs that I love, all songs that I find are extremely well-written, brilliant, beautiful songs.
Yeah.
And to me, there's something that you can feel when you play a song that's well-constructed. You can't always put your hand or your finger or your... describe what it is, but there's something about the interaction between the changes and the lyrics that feels a certain way. So sort of a test for my songs is I need to be able to throw them in the middle of these sets and them not be the ugly duckling.
Yeah.
And that's kind of that's somewhat of a subjective thing, but I've learned to be, going back to what I was saying earlier about there not being mistakes and just the revision process, I've learned to be extremely, extremely critical and ruthless when critiquing or revising or editing my own work.
Yeah.
So, I was asked one time, someone made a comment about I'd played a set that was 10 songs or whatever. And, I was talking to another songwriter and they said, I can't believe you wrote 10 songs and that was them. I said, well, you shouldn't believe it because it's not true. For every one that's kept, there's 6 or 8 that you'll never hear.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's part of just developing that process, developing the practice, the discipline of doing it.
Yeah.
And taking that burden off of yourself that everyone has to be right.
Yeah.
Everyone has to be perfect. Everyone has to be good.
Yeah.
Just do it.
And then, too, I think with some songwriters, what I have heard them, speak about is that, some of those songs go back on a shelf and they weren't right for that time.
Right.
But then they come out and maybe either stay what their original form was or bit of tweaking and now they're right for this time.
Sometimes it takes a very long time for you to figure out how to play them.
Yeah. Well, that's a good point. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. It might be a great song. It just might be you're not sure how to
present
the final. Exactly. Yeah. Huh, that's a good point.
And sometimes that takes another perspective of looking at it, which sometimes you get from other people.
Yeah,
I've written songs before where it touched on things that was completely unintentional, but things that I would certainly not want to associate with. So I've gone in after knowing, that it could draw up those associations and change things, remove things, taking things out.
Yeah. Huh, very interesting. Can you do another one for us?
Sure, sure. All right. Let's see, I need to change my...
You have how many in there, 5?
I have 6 in this case.
So, yeah, they're all different keys. Is that how it works with harmonica?
Right.
All different,
it does.
Yeah.
So depending on which key you play in, you need to pick a different harmonica.
Yeah, yeah.
And then after that, there's no wrong notes.
Yeah.
So picking the correct one becomes very important. I like to say that I keep the harmonica on for whenever I forget the lyric. I'm kind of excited that the presidential primaries are coming back around again. I love the beginning particularly because that's whenever the most, eccentric of the candidates are around.
That's right. They're still there.
Before they, the ones who know how to bite their tongues can, hold out to the end.
Yeah.
This song was written after a particularly entertaining Rick Perry speech.
All right.
Well, Texas love, Texas life. You're wearing a hat 10 times your size. There's boots on the ground. Smoke in the sky. Black iron dinosaurs sucking blood from sad sweet Mithra's thighs. Taste love, don't waste love. You can't cheat love, sweet love. You're gonna need love, real love. If you ever plan to get enough. Texas wine, black clouds roll from seafloor to seaside. There's boots on the ground, but no birds in the sky. And sheet metal sea serpents silently still on a wide horizon of fire. And boots on the ground, but no birds
in the sky. And taste love, don't waste love. You can't cheat love, sweet love. You're gonna need love, real love. You ever plan to get enough? To show love, you gotta know love. You can't steal love, gotta feel love. You're gonna need love, real love. You ever plan to get enough?
That was Jason Harrington. The name of that song again?
That's a song called Texas Teabag.
Texas Teabag.
Speaking of word associations.
Very nice. A lot of meaning in that song.
It sure does.
You have done a lot of art with your hands, from sculpting to playing instruments. You are now creating amps.
I am.
And building amps. How did that start out?
In a few ways. I had gotten my hands on an old guitar amp that needed to be fixed. Kind of doing some research and things like that. One of the things I learned when I was in school for sculpture was how to figure things out, how to research things, how to learn things, where to go to get information.
Yeah.
Because in an art curriculum, unlike other curriculums, you aren't given knowledge so much as you are taught processes and techniques.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I kind of took it upon myself to dive into this electronic circuit and see if I could figure something out.
Yeah.
How hard can it be?
Yeah.
And was instantly hooked.
Huh.
What
hooked you?
The interaction between different components, how one little piece of metal and insulator can change things, and the fact that it's a physical thing.
Yeah.
That
yeah.
sound and electricity and light is all the same thing.
Hmm.
And that once I got into the internals of an amplifier, I could see how it worked.
Yeah.
And it wasn't so, you know, and it became very interesting as a medium.
Yeah.
To be able to sculpt electricity in a way.
Yeah. So had you known anybody that was, I mean, how did you learn? Is that self-taught?
I've got my hands on quite a few old engineering books from the 30s and 40s.
Yeah.
Because they're written not only using the same technology that I'm working in, but they're written in English, I call it. It's not a lot of jargon. It's the things are kind of explained from the ground up.
Yeah.
So that a person without a background can understand them.
Sure.
So I did that. I did lots and lots of research online, watched lots and lots of videos, and just dug through basically technical articles and things. And then just got in and electrocuted myself a few times. And learn some things
huh?
that
yeah.
way. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
I've nearly burned our house down quite a few times.
Yeah, wow. That's a way to learn, huh? What not to do again.
That's it. There's nothing that'll teach you quite like correcting your own mistakes.
Yeah. But, you know, besides the art of that process that goes inside, then there's also the the case, too.
I do. With the things that I build, I kind of like to have my hands involved in everything. So the cabinets are completely handmade wood cabinets. I use lots of, you know, traditional furniture building techniques and finishing techniques.
Yeah.
The metalwork for the chassis that I build is all hand cut, hand done.
I want to back up to the wood. Is there certain woods that are better for affect sound at all?
They are. There are certain woods, depending on the density, the hardness, the grain structure, they just resonate in different ways. One of the things that I find interesting about guitar amps as opposed to, say, high-fidelity speakers.
Okay.
In a high-fidelity speaker, the cabinet is not supposed to interfere with the sound at all. It's meant to be transparent. It should sound the way the CD sounds.
Oh, interesting.
Or the music sounds, the recording sounds. In a guitar amplifier, it's just the opposite.
Yeah.
Anything I can do to encourage the cabinet to add a pleasant texture to the overall sound.
And I'm not sure if this question is going to come out right, but is it because how the sound coming out of the guitar would resonate off the outside of
correct.
That case,
the actual physical waves that are coming out resonate through the wood of the cabinet.
Oh,
in just
okay.
the way an
yeah.
acoustic instrument would work.
Okay. All right.
And so you get it influences the sound in that way.
And what about the metal? Same thing? Or
It does a few different things. I like to work with copper. One of my favorite.
It's expensive.
It's beautiful, though.
Yeah, it is beautiful.
I like things that age gracefully.
I
like things that as they're used, as they're beat up, that they actually become more beautiful.
Yeah, that's right. And copper is one of those.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so, and not only that, but in electrically, it's the perfect material based on a few of its characteristics.
And that you have experimented with, right,
have,
in terms of
I
different
have.
Types of?
I've used quite a few different materials to build the chassis. Some of them are harder to work with. Some of them are easier to work with.
And when
with.
You say the chassis, is that the?
That's the actual frame that the amplifier is built inside of.
Right, okay,
that the
got
electronics
it.
Are built inside
got
of.
It.
It's a metal okay. box, basically.
Okay, all right. And then they're made, and this is where I'm not sure if I'm going to ask questions. But so there are some that specifically are for acoustic, some specifically for electric guitar.
Right.
Right? I should know that.
My favorite thing to do is to work with artists to produce an amp that's going to do exactly what they want it to do.
For the style and the sound
exactly,
they play.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. So I recently worked with Mark Moe of the Mercy Brothers to create an amp that we boiled it down to one knob. And that basically lets him determine how loud he wants it because everything else is built in there to where it's going to sound exactly the way he wants it to sound. And he controls everything from that guitar, from that slide, and from his hands. And he does a phenomenal job with it.
Interesting. Yeah. You know, and that goes – yeah, that's interesting about you, Jason, about how tuned in you are to sound, number one, but feel.
And that's what I find. Once you – the amplifier becomes an extension of your instrument.
Sure.
To where your playing actually manipulates the sound.
Yeah, yeah.
Rather than it just sounding like whatever it's going to sound like.
Yeah, yeah. So you have you play through your own?
I do.
How long ago did were you able to do that, where you played through your own amp?
The first one that that worked
was
about 4 years ago.
Okay.
It was the first amp that I built. That amp is actually out on the road with Dax Riggs right now.
Ah, okay.
So,
It's
seeing the country, which is pretty cool.
Yeah. Have some stories to tell when it gets
it.
Back.
So, but one thing, the amps are, they're, I put a lot of work into the woodwork, the finish.
Yeah, yeah.
But at the same time, I'm totally open to the idea of them getting beat up.
Yeah.
And them getting aged.
Yeah.
You know, I like that concept in all things, whether it's music or...
Or the instrument, too. You know, instruments that you have. You know, you'll hear people talk, I mean, not beat up to the
right.
point where you can't use them, but
correct, right.
that aging.
Yeah.
It's interesting because you'll hear instrument makers talk about how you just talked about the amp. You know, there's quite a similarity in terms of how I've heard instrument makers talk about, you know, how they're building, whether it's a fiddle or a guitar.
Right.
You know, what that extension is and what that sound coming out. Same thing with the amps.
It is.
Yeah. Very nice. Can you do another one for us, or you want to play one off your CD? Can you do another live one?
Sure.
Okay.
Sure. Let's see what we got.
And then we'll go out on.
Okay.
We've got a little time, though. I know you've got a. You guys are going to start working on a new CD, so.
We are. We are actually. I'm working with Lucas Broussard at his studio out in Kaplan. Lucas did our Specklers record.
Okay.
He plays with the Specklers whenever he's in.
What instrument does he play?
He does bass guitar.
He plays bass. Okay.
But he's a phenomenal producer. So we're going to start working very soon, or we have started working, but we're going to kind of pick back up. We're going to take the live Speckler's show that we've been working and kind of use that in the studio, and that we try different combinations of players and to kind of allow them to kind of shape the song in that way.
Very nice.
So, actually, speaking of that Speckler's album, this is a song that came off of the Speckler's. It was the title track, In the Clover. And kind of what we were talking about earlier, about taking a while to learn how to play songs. When I wrote this one.
It was the last one on the CD, though, right?
This was the last one on the CD. When I wrote this, I didn't know too much what I was thinking about. I was kind of trying to put something cohesive together. In the Clover refers to the time in between crops, you know, when you're replenishing the soil.
Yeah.
I thought that was a nice concept and was kind of working through that. And it wasn't until later that me and Lucas realized that this song was definitely about a friend of ours who we had lost to cancer.
Uh-huh.
And on that record, we were actually able to take some of his old music that he had recorded and integrated into the sounds of the song.
Very cool. Yeah, you had talked about. Very nice. I'd forgotten about that.
Now, so
what was his name?
His name was Shane Hebert.
Shane Hebert. Okay.
I love this little guitar, but it's fussy.
It's a It's a half size. No.
Yeah.
It's a half size classical guitar. It's beautiful. Too bad we're on the radio for people to see it. But you get to hear it, so that's the best part.
Come on. Come on in. Where have you been? My old friend. Sit down, sit right there, pull up a chair, let down your hair. What's that? What's that you say? You're gone away, you're gone to stay. Let loose, you just let it go. These things you know, they come and go. You say it comes like a freight train, it comes like the rain, it pours through your window like water through an old storm drain. Runs through the floodgates like the bulls in Spain. Before too long, they'll come again. Come again. At times, we put our friends down, down in the ground, down in the ground, until they come back around, they come in right now, so keep a lookout. Come with freight trains, they come with the rain, they pour through your windows like water through old storm drains, they run through the floodgates
like the bulls in Spain. Before too long, they'll come again. Come again. Come on, you come on in. Where have you been, my old friend? Let loose, yeah, just let it go. These things, you know, they come and go.
If you're just joining us, that was Jason Harrington in The Clover. That was a beautiful, beautiful song, Jason.
Thank you.
Do you have an idea of how many songs you're going to look at for this next one? Or
well, what we're going to probably do is put on an EP, so probably five or six songs.
Okay.
We're thinking with the way things are changing with digital music and everything, probably going to make more sense for us to go that route. It takes such a long time for us to put together a full album.
Yeah.
And it also allows us to kind of be a little more conceptual with the combination of the songs on the album. So it'll probably be within the next 6 months, the first EP will come out, and then I'll look to put out a second one.
Oh, very nice.
Before the end of next year.
Yeah. So do you write with other people at all?
I have. Not often. Because of the way I do things, I'm very slow and tedious.
Okay.
And I may produce, 10 pages of junk to make half a page of anything worth reading.
Do you want it? Yeah.
And so I have a trouble being that open with those 10 pages with people. That being said, I've written with Steve Bro before. We write really well together because we get along really well together.
Yeah.
And I've written with Lucas Broussard, who produces things. Yeah. Actually, the song you mentioned earlier, Big Blue, me and Lucas.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Did that one together. But for the most part, I write on my own.
When you go into the studio, is it are you comfortable with things changing as it goes, or do you go in pretty well, like, this is how I want it to be,
it's set? I'm very, very comfortable with it changing. In fact, one of the things with the live performance has been to, by calling in sit-in musicians, I can't prepare them with a part.
Yeah.
But it becomes... The fun for me, or the interesting part for me, is who those people are. So everyone who I play with is much more likely to listen first, play second, if that makes sense.
And
where it becomes interesting is as they listen to one another, they work together and they start to communicate musically rather than just playing whole time. And I find in those places where the songs sound the best. I present the songs as a progression, a melody, and lyrics. And from there, Lucas does a lot of work with producing them for the album. He's got a very good ear for that kind of thing.
Now, does Lucas play in other...
He does. He plays with Dax Riggs as well.
Oh, that's right. He plays. Okay.
He's played with Thomas Fields in the past.
Oh, okay,
he's
got
done
it.
A few things. Yeah. He's a songwriter as well.
Yeah. Yeah, so something you've known for a while and real comfortable with.
We've been playing together since we were teenagers, really.
Ah, okay.
So, isn't really anybody else I would trust more with my music than Lucas.
Yeah. Well, if I want to mention, you do have some dates coming up for people to be able to see you in the area and close to the area. But you had mentioned Dax Riggs. You're going to be playing this Friday.
Correct. We'll be out at the station in Broussard. I'll be doing a set opening up around 10 o'clock, and then Dax Riggs will follow, I suspect, close to 11. So that should be a really good time.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And then you are going to be talking about your buddy Mark Moe. You're going to be Specklers will play a bill with the Mercy Brothers at Chelsea's Cafe in Baton Rouge.
This will actually be, oddly enough, both of our Baton Rouge debuts with our bands.
We've both
done the plays in different settings, or, you know, I've done solo things out there. But I hadn't had the opportunity to take the Specklers out there yet. So I'm very excited to do that.
Yeah, yeah. That's a good bill, the two of you guys.
It should be. It should be a good night.
You know, I'm curious, because when we mentioned Mark, I know we're getting short on time here, but, you know, the Hoot Nights.
Right.
I think have played a really important part for a lot of musicians in the area. I mean, do you see a role that...
Oh, certainly. You mean Kevin?
Yeah, with the Hoot Nights.
Yeah, Kevin.
Kevin Sacani.
Yeah, he would organize the Hoot Nights. For those who don't know where they are, he would pick a certain artist. Six or eight bands would perform three or four songs by that artist. And it's been an unbelievable community builder.
It has, hasn't it?
Well, that's how we've gotten to know each other.
Yeah, exactly.
Through
that's
playing
first
with Tartu.
I saw you. Yeah.
And that's actually how I've gotten to know Kevin and a few of those guys, and it's been really, really great for that, not to mention a blast.
Yeah, they are really fun. But I've seen what I assumed were some pairings or some joinings that came out of that Hoot Night.
Oh, certainly.
You know, people that met and, hey, sit in on this you know. So, yeah, that's a really cool thing. And
there were quite a few that were specifically created for the Hoot Night as well.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Very, very nice. Well, listen, find out more about Jason Harrington and go to his Facebook page.
Correct.
You also have – we didn't even get into talking about Folkster Pup. You also have a publishing company.
I do.
Folkster.
I do.
And it's folksterpublishing.com.
Right.
We'll have to have you come back.
Sounds good.
And talk about that. But some great writings on there.
Thank you, for
some people to check out. But we can go out with – you want to go out with Intangible?
That would be great.
And everybody, have a good week. Jason Harrington.
Thank you.
When you go, you leave me here intangible. A little distorted, a little morose, a little difficult to diagnose. When you come back on your own, you'll find me here in tangled clothes. Tangled ribbon, tangled bow, tangled fingers, tangled toes. Southern Belle, dirty, dirty water sang to me from the river below. There ain't a light I could see could pacify this passing ocean.